Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Michael Leader.
On the show this week, cracks form on the shell of a perfect family in Hatching. Coming of age ain't all it's cracked up to be in Funny Pages. And in Film Club, it's back to supernatural eggs in Mamoru Oshii's animated masterpiece, Angel's Egg. And I'll also be talking to artist Dan Guthrie about his part in a new touring film program, Right of Way. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Ah, well, what is there to say beyond that Michael's back? Michael, what have you been up to? Yay!
Oh, hi. Wow, it's been a while since I've been on the show, and even longer since I've been a guest on the show. That's wild. How are we all doing, Leila?
Okay? Feeling very much like an imposter. Like that I'm on the wrong side of this running order. But...
This is like the Spider-Man meme where you're kind of like pointing at each other, isn't it? Like, no, you're the host. No, you're the host.
Yeah, wow. It's wild to be back. Thank you for inviting me back for Egg Week.
Well, you know, we would have you in your insights for every week, but this seemed a particularly apt thing since you are, you know, such an expert on all the things animated. How is everything going with your podcast on the subject, Ghibliotech?
Oh, Ghibliotech's going strong. We've just finished a mini-series on stop-motion animation. We looked at the filmographies of director Henry Selick, who made two goth touchstones for two separate generations, The Nightmare Before Christmas and Coraline, and he's about to do the same again for Wendell and Wilde. So great to dive into his filmography. Then we also spun off in a different direction to follow the work of Leica Studios, who are the stop-motion animation studios based in Portland, Oregon, that made Box Trolls and Kubo and the Two Strings and Missing Link. So we've just stop-motion. We moved away from anime for a little bit, but in the sidelines, Jake, my co-host, and I have been writing a book that's coming out in about a month's time, fingers crossed, depending on shipping delays. Mm-hmm. It's the Ghibliotech anime movie guide.
Is Angel's Egg in that?
It's mentioned, yeah. So we set ourselves the task of providing 30 gateways into the world of Japanese animation, so 30 separate feature films. And we set ourselves a task of only one film per filmmaker. And so, of course, we had to go with Ghost in the Shell for Mamoru Oshii. But we did also, where we could, where we had titans of the industry, we made space to talk about their other films as well. So Angel's Egg is talked about in the book as well.
Cool.
I swear you just wrote a book. Like, the pace with which you are writing this book is making you feel extremely lazy.
Well, we don't have much else to do, really. out here in mid-Sussex, there's not a lot going on to distract me from writing books. So yeah, the Ghibliotech book came out this week a year ago. And now we've got another book coming out in October. So yeah, it's really wild to have a podcast that turns into a book.
Well, I can only hope to kind of follow in those footsteps. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that we've been on together since it's all been announced, but extremely grateful to be you to for everything you did with this podcast. And it's been really nice trying to keep up your standards and keeping it going forward.
Oh, cheers, Leila. But also you're absolutely, you know, prime standard broadcaster in your own right. So really, it was easy to hand over the baton to you. And I'm not joking when I said that you'll bring me back for Egg Week. I did wonder if this was an in-joke because my son, 3-year-old son, is called Ivo. And when people ask about where we got that name from, there are a few famous Ivos out there. Ivo Graham, the stand-up comedian. Ivo Watts Russell, founder of 4AD Records. Or Dr. Ivo Robotnik from the Sonic the Hedgehog movies, also known as Dr. Eggman. So I thought this was what you were just digging the knife in my side there.
Wow. Well, I mean, given how much David hated the Sonic the Hedgehog films, that would be like a bit of a dig to Ivo. And we would certainly not come for a toddler on a platform such as this.
Good, I'll apologise on your behalf to him.
Join our communities of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our SETI HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Tinja, a young gymnast, is desperate to please her mother, who is in turn obsessed with presenting the image of a perfect family on her popular blog. One day, Tinja finds a mysterious egg and brings it home, only to be unprepared for what is growing inside. I mean, we say that this is an egg movie, and in some ways it is, but this egg hatches pretty early on, so this is mostly a monster movie, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. This is one of those where it has an amazing still, an amazing poster of this sort of teenage girl cradling a massive egg on her bed. But yes, I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that egg does hatch, and inside the egg is an allegory. It is a monster movie. There is this bird-type creature inside the egg. We should say how maybe this bird egg is introduced into this world. It's this beautiful, pristine, Instagram-ready Finnish family home. Everything is designed to a T by this mother who is a wannabe mummy blogger or domestic goddess blogger. And in the opening scene, a bird, a black bird, kind of crashes into this home and they have to get rid of it. And the little girl buries the bird, but then this egg comes into the life of the family. And I say it's an allegory. It really is one of those films, the sort of post-Babadook films, where there's this seesaw between the text and subtext of a horror movie, whether a monster movie or is it an allegorical monster movie, how much is the subtext being prioritised over the text? And it's quite a rich one, I think, for the majority of this film, where we have this girl as she is reaching adolescence or going through adolescence and having responsibilities, feelings, impulses of her own within the family household, maybe stepping out of the shadow of a controlling mother, while all the while there is this literal monster under her bed that's growing that she has to look after.
There was a term that I think A.A. Dowd came up with earlier this year referring to horror, referring to men and, you know, calling for an end of what he termed metaphora, where it's just that we go all metaphor and kind of actually forget to be scary. Like, David, did the balance of this work for you?
Yeah, kind of. I was a bit like, yeah, I maybe thought that, like, it was less a case of the balance not working and more a case of, like, I did feel like there was elements of this story that I'd seen done better in other places, maybe. So more a case of like it maybe wasn't necessarily taking its idea into an area that I felt was like truly unique and exciting. I mean, there's definitely this kind of, I think in the second half of the film where this very kind of postcard picture perfect family starts to disintegrate, and I mean, and that they're very much kind of like, there is a sort of caricature element to it in that the son and the father are kind of, they look exactly the same, and they're both sort of semi despised by the women in the family for having they have these big round glasses and a very clean cut and are kind of annoying. So like there are all these kind of festering tensions at the beginning, and from the off, as you say, Michael, there's the scene which sort of gets the plot rolling, in which this blackbird. I don't know what type of bird it is actually, but this sort of like raven looking bird kind of comes through the window, and the mother who takes quite some amount of glee in sort of snapping its neck to sort of put it out of its misery, smiling at the daughter who's looking back up at her in kind of abject horror, like how could someone be so brutal. And I think the film is exploring this idea of like through the metaphors and through the monsters and through these kind of like these sort of presences in that are introduced into the family, into the lives of, like, you know, being able to like the sudden breakdown and sudden changes, and whether that is the you know, the sort of coming of age of the female heroine who's young and she's being sort of hectored and pushed by her mother to attain excellence in the field of gymnastics, and you know, it's a kind of that sort of plays out in almost a sort of like parental abuse storyline. And then you've also got this kind of these other ways where this you know, these changes are coming, and like the way that I mean, maybe we won't go into what actually happens, but like the monster itself, I call it, yeah, the sort of bird monster itself, which is very much modelled on a kind of Jim Henson Dark Crystal type physical model, changes too in a way that sort of really expands out the sort of metaphorical aspects. But yeah, I definitely thought it was an interesting film, but I maybe thought it lacked a kind of like a wow factor, like it, like to just push things up into that sort of higher gear and, you know, reach a level of surprise that I don't think it may be, like, you know, that definitely, certainly, like, there's an ambition there, but maybe would have liked it to go a bit further.
I mean, at times it reminded me of a film I like very much called Ginger Snaps, where the werewolf is very much a kind of metaphor for puberty, and this film is not subtle with that allegory. There's a lot of kind of period references and stuff, but I think where I found it most interesting was the idea of coming of age also horrifyingly turning into sort of becoming your own mother, which for so many people is like a deep dark fear. Not my mum. My mum is brilliant if she's listening to this. Michael, how did you find the sort of parent child, I suppose in this case mother daughter relationship within the film?
Yeah, I thought that this film has bags of ideas, and the ideas are very strong. I'd probably characterise it as a film that's better to read than to watch, in a way, as in horror is such an arresting genre, but it's also one that can, you know, sustain analysis. This is one where all the way through I was picking up on all this stuff. The parental relationship, I think that Sophia Hakala, who's the mother in this, gives a really fantastic performance, and has to anchor this point, as you said, about the mother-daughter relationship and the horror in some ways of either going either way, becoming your mother or becoming some aberrant monster that your mother may not approve of, which is puberty, right? Where that's what I think this film nails quite well, the moment where you have almost a second birth or a second coming of age, where it's moving away from your parents and becoming something different from the family homestead, something that can't be aggressively micromanaged by a parent, because she is just the ultimate micromanaging parent, to the point of she's the daughter is a gymnast, or at least that's what her mother wants her to be, and she's forcing her to train and train and train to achieve perfection. And of course, gymnastics is another great sort of rich allegorical metaphorical thing to throw into the pot here, because it is a world of perfect form. So when you're tackling something as imperfect as young adulthood or teenhood, it's a good contrast to have that rub up against.
And I really like that. I suppose it's the aesthetic of the film. As much as this is kind of set within a kind of modern day social media obsessed world, there's that element of the Stepford Wife, to, you know, the way that everybody's perfectly coiffured, and there is I think an 80s vibe to it somehow. Perhaps that's just the Dark Crystal of it all that I'm picking up on.
Well, I thought that one of the things that this reminded me of actually was the kind of was Roald Dahl and it felt like a kind of maybe a sort of more specifically feminine Roald Dahl movie, and as you say, I agree with you about that performance. Sophia Heitkler coming across like a very classic like Roald Dahl female character, like a Miss Trunchbull or who else would it be? Or what, one of the one of the witches in The Witch, like she has that kind of like slightly terrifying aura about her where you feel that she could kind of pull off her skin and reveal this kind of monster underneath her as well. Going back to what you're saying before, Layla, I think one of my issues with the film is that maybe in comparison to something like Ginger Snaps, it didn't like, I don't think it delivered for me on the sort of horror side of things, like on the sort of the more kind of like down home genre aspect where I'm not sure I felt sort of scared or, I wasn't compelled in this way that horror, like the good horror delivers. And I think the thing about a film like Ginger Snaps is it really works on both levels. The metaphor and the genre, the genre story are just very, very perfectly balanced to the point where you kind of can't see which has the supremacy. Whereas this is very much like the metaphors, the ideas, the allegory is, front loaded into the material, and the scares are something of a, not an afterthought, but like they're there as a sort of necessary element rather than something that has been kind of really sort of charged into the material. But that's not to say it's not an enjoyable film in its own right. It's one of those. I think sometimes people, it's a film that I think you could argue over in terms of what it actually is. Because like, is it horror? Is it a kind of art movie? Is it a family drama? Is it like sort of Buñuel or something that's like a sort of sly domestic satire? I mean, it sort of falls between all these stools. And I think in this instance, you're kind of like, well, yeah, I kind of wish I knew a bit more about what this was.
I mean, a monstrous bird is eating people. A family drama would be, I think, a bit of a stretch. But I suppose the context of this is that this was a Sundance movie, and Sundance is kind of known for being now, I suppose since the Blair Witch Project, always being at like the forefront of like where the horror genre is going. And this, I mean, if you want to see a heavy-handed metaphor, you should have attended that festival. My God, Fresh was an absolute abomination when it came to that. But yeah, I'd say this and a film called Speak No Evil out of that festival did feel like fresh new voices to me. What do you think, Michael? Do you think this is kind of possibly an indicator of where the horror genre is going, away from the elevated and into the more kind of gross practical effects side of things?
Well, I did love the gross practical effects, and it is something that develops throughout the film, and the Skeksis dark crystal type bird was wonderful to see. I still think we've got one foot in that horrible term elevated horror, because it is about these metaphors and ideas rather than going full tilt or grimy or gory in a Ty West Rob Zombie way, perhaps. But Hannah Bergholm, I was very impressed by this film on that level, because she does have a very delicate visual language throughout the film for building the world of the movie to sustain the ideas, the creating the pristine world of the home to then focus in on literally the cracks and the scars and the buried secrets. And it's a very rich film to read in that sense. I will definitely be looking out for more from her. Also, you talk about this in the context of horror. In the context of national cinema, this is a Finnish movie, and the Finnish national cinema is not really one that gets much in the way of wide-scale distribution in the UK. And actually, this month we have two films coming out from Finland. We have this and Girls, Girls, Girls coming out, I think, next week. So that is something of a novelty, I suppose you could say, but something that marks this out as something different.
Well, we should probably get some scores on this. David, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I probably am going to go threes across the board on it. Like, I was really kind of balanced, you know. I think there were sort of things I liked, things I liked less. I wasn't like, for me, a Sundance breakout doesn't necessarily mean like something I'm going to be like running to, because I think sometimes those breakouts can be a bit iffy when they sort of finally reach these shores. But this one, I think, is definitely deserved of that name. I love the practical effects, and yeah, I think Hannah Bergholm is definitely someone to watch. I think my anticipation for her next film will be a 4, whatever happens, because you know this was really, really good.
Michael, what about you?
Threes across the board, but you know, strong threes, I suppose. As we've spoken about at length, this is very rich on the ideas level, but it didn't just pop off in the way I'd like a film like this to.
Well, I am going to slightly more generously go with fours across the board. Not that I knew anything about her, but as Michael mentioned, the image that this was sold with was such a compelling one. And I think of a, particularly having watched it in such a sort of a period of that Sundance seemed to be a lot of horror films that really didn't want to be horror films. They wanted to be dramas, and they just had to package themselves up in a way to make them elevated A24 horror, whatever you want to say. It's a ridiculous term. So I felt, at least watching this, that Hannah Bergholm was really embracing and enjoying being in this genre. So yes, I will be very excited for what she does next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Launching on the 20th of September 2022 and touring until September 23, Right of Way comprises of 3 new film commissions plus a curated programme of archive film examining themes of access and inclusion in the UK countryside. The films cover themes ranging from the absence of ethnically diverse people in the pastoral narrative through to protest, trespassing, activism and rape. I spoke to artist, researcher and writer Dan Guthrie, whose practice often explores representations of Black Britishness, about the programme and his film Black Strangers, which sees him play tribute to a man named Daniel who died in Stroud in 1719.
Uh,
So I guess we'll kind of start at the beginning. This kind of collection of films is talking about different people being like excluded from rural spaces. What did that mean to you?
Well, so I live in a rural area at the moment. I live in Stroud in Gloucestershire. And my mum's family moved from Jamaica to Stroud as part of the Windrush migration back in the 60s. So they've always lived here. I've lived here for most of my life. But as is the case, sometimes there's this feeling that perhaps I don't belong in this landscape that is, I think, as much mine as anyone else's. Yeah.
So you feel like a sense of connection to a space. It's just kind of more of an outward force that's telling you that it doesn't belong to you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I look out the window now, my view is like over the valleys of Stroud, and it's an absolutely gorgeous view, but I probably don't go for a walk there as much as I'd like to, just because I'm aware that sort of entering that space may not be just as easy as like hopping over a stile as it is for some people.
And in your piece, you're kind of using this person called Daniel's story to kind of express that feeling that you have. How did you come to Daniel?
So I was doing some research for something else. I've been part of this council-led review panel looking at, amongst other things, an object in Stroud called the Black Boy Clock, which was made in the midst of the transatlantic slave trade. It's still up today, and it's on the same street as my old primary school. But yeah, I was doing all this sort of research around the clock, around historical Black presences in the area at the time of its creation, and that's when I came across Daniel. I think it was probably one of those sort of post Black Lives Matter, let's try and do something documents, and it was sort of like a list of all the historical Black presences from parish records in Gloucestershire, and I was just going through it, and yeah, saw this one record, which is for Daniel, no surname, described as a Black stranger and buried on the 31st of December 1719 in Nimsfield, which is just down the road from me. And my first thought was like, that's my name, which I know is a very like base level thought, but it's just something that sort of like when you're combing through all this data, sometimes something just like pops out to you. And I was like, there's something there, you know?
Yeah. And so, I mean, part of this sort of, as well as kind of a almost being documentary style, it sort of ends up being like almost a memorial to Daniel. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. Definitely a memorial. I mean, with this sort of work I've been doing around this clock in Stroud, I've been thinking a lot about who gets remembered, how they get remembered, all those sort of questions. And something that I really, I guess, toy with in the piece is trying to work out how to commemorate someone who you don't really know. Yeah. And I think I've tried to do that pretty well. I guess obviously it's up to the viewer, but I think I've given it my best shot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give away how it ends, but I found it like intensely moving as a sort of a tribute to someone who otherwise would be, you know, completely lost to the annals of history.
Yeah. It's quite a dramatic ending, I think I'll say. I'll leave it at that, and people can watch and make up their own minds about that.
So there are these two other films that kind of all part of this, you know, largely commissioned piece. Like, how do you feel your work is kind of in conversation with those other pieces?
I think it's interesting. I've only seen them recently. We had a preview screening up at Berwick Film and Media Arts Festival. And it's interesting because the work of the other two, Mufoma and Arjuna, their works are maybe not as didactic as mine is, but I think they both sort of, take on the subject in quite different ways. Mufoma's work kind of feels like you're stepping into like someone else's childhood memories, and is quite sort of enveloping in that way. And Arjuna's work is a lot more driven by, I guess, the history of like raves in the countryside. So they're very different in that way. Like, one's a lot quieter and one's, I don't want to say noisier, but has a different energy. And I think mine sort of like slots in between the two in that kind of a register.
And is there anything particular that you'd like people to take away from this when they kind of leave, hopefully getting to see this at a film festival or, you know, the various places it's going to be screened?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think I can like try and change people's minds completely with all these questions about, you know, access to rural spaces. You know, there are loads of movements at the moment doing all this sort of work, you know, the Right to Roam movement, Flock Together as well. I think I'd like to maybe, you know, sort of start the spark of those conversations, you know, when people think either I'm taking being in this space for granted or why am I not allowed in this space? You know, I think, yeah, sparking those conversations would be quite good.
Yeah, it does feel that now is a time where we can ask kind of bigger questions that we did than before about what national identity really means.
Yeah.
And what it means, you know, on a geographical level, not just in terms of, you know, hashtags.
Yeah, yeah. I think as well, you know, the sort of the program launch is happening, I think, the day after the Queen's funeral, mm-hmm. which I think has definitely raised a lot of questions about who are symbols of national identity. And I'm not saying that I'm claiming to be one of those, but I think maybe this program might help to expand people's understanding of, you know, who is expected to be in different types of spaces.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Right of Way will launch on the 20th of September at the Lewis Depot, and then will play in cinemas, film festivals and community screenings across the UK. A teenage cartoonist rejects the comforts of his suburban life and leaves home, finding an unwilling teacher and unwitting friend in Wallace, a former low-level comic artist. So, David, this was Owen Klein's directorial debut. He's quite the character. Did you see this in Cannes? I believe that's where it was first shown.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so Owen Klein, just to give a little bit of context, you may not recognise the name, but if you have seen a film called The Squid and the Whale by Noah Baumbach, he was an actor in that film, and he played Jesse Eisenberg's younger brother, who is a bit of a kind of scene stealer in the film. And he has now all grown up and has sort of parlayed his, let's say, quite idiosyncratic passions that he has accrued over the last 20 years, or since 2005, into this, you know, really exceptional debut feature. And to give you a sense of the flavour as well, it's a film that is produced by the Safdie brothers and is very much kind of stylistically, tonally, sits within their kind of domain of filmmaking. It's that stressy, hectic, eccentric type of cinema that they make, and this is kind of Owen Klein's take on that, if you will. The story is one which sees a high school kid played by Daniel Zolgadri, who is a kind of budding artist, and he's reached this point in his career where he is at a kind of crossroads where he can either jack in high school and go and follow his dream of becoming a comic artist, or he can listen to his parents and finish high school and then go whichever way he wants after that. And what with him being you know, an independently minded teen and you know, not the most kind of thoughtful or what's the word, like he's not the most thoughtful or considerate of people, he decides to take his own road, This is following a the fact that one of his beloved tutors, art tutors, is kind of randomly killed in the sort of intro to the film after having told him that he should follow his dreams of becoming an artist and that he's too good to be sort of sucked into the school system. And so the film essentially follows his journey of kind of budding independence, where he is going on his own, leaving the family nest, a family nest that it's worth saying is extremely comfortable, middle class, suburban. And he has decided to stump out on his own, where he falls into a job becoming a kind of legal typist, and then using his very small wage to rent a room in a place called Trenton, New Jersey, which I understand is one of the you know, it's like one of the bottom five cities in America. So like kind of the joke is very much lost on sort of non-US, non sort of East Coast viewers, but yeah, it's not a nice place to live. And he ends up kind of living with these two older guys in a, I mean, I'm going to call it a sweaty basement, but like that doesn't really do justice to the actual physical confines of this place. And to be honest, I'm not going to say any more because you just kind of have to see it to believe it. But it's really, I mean, you know, going back to what we were saying in Hatching about, well, what is horror? What is, you know, what is comedy? It's like there are definitely kind of like horror elements to this film in terms of what the production design brings to the story. And sorry, I'm getting to the end of this. He then happens across a guy called Wallace who is he certainly has some issues of his own, and it transpires that he was a colorist for Image Comics, which is a kind of like indie comic label. In fact, Michael, you might have to correct me here. It's like, is it still going, or was it?
Oh yeah,
sort of
going
like,
strong.
Going strong. Okay.
The Walking Dead came from Image Comics.
Right. Okay. But they've been going through the 90s and noughts, I think. And this guy worked as a kind of colorist on their comics, and Robert is instantly in awe of him and feels like he's some kind of like sign in this future that he wants. Oh my God, I've bumped into this guy who worked on these comics that I love, and I have to kind of endear myself to him. Wallace absolutely doesn't want anything to do with him. So yes, that's the story in a nutshell. So you have all these tensions, settings and people, and you know, you're just seeing Robert making a big hash of his life as these kind of late teenagers tend to do. And it's just a very, very funny film. I mean, I'll let Michael take the baton now because I could rattle on, but I'll stop at the point by saying it's a comedy and it's really funny. I laughed a lot in the film, not just at the jokes, but at the production design, at the music choices, at the editing and the performances. Yeah, it's just I mean, a lot of energy has gone into making sure this film is funny and it succeeds.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself having a similar reaction to Robert when Wallace came out, because, you know, he's played by Matthew Mayer, who is like an absolutely extraordinary stage actor. If anyone ever gets the chance to watch his performance in The Flick, which has got quite a lot of parallels with this film in terms of like comfortable suburban kid trying to, you know, get some authentic life experience. And he is so extraordinary in this. I was so pleased that he actually gets a big chunky role rather than the kind of small cameos that he gets. But Michael, for you, this is that, you know, there's a lot of influence clearly from like that kind of trash art, Kuchar Brothers, John Waters, like a grimy underworld. Did that repulse you, or did you have fun with it?
I mean, we speak a lot about event cinema screenings. I watched this at the height of the heat wave over the summer on my sofa on a screener link. And so watching this sticky, sweaty film in such a, it would almost be cheating to watch this film in an air-conditioned atmosphere. It's definitely picking up the baton from that, as well as coming in the wake of comics adjacent films of the last 20-30 years, like the documentary about Crumb and then Ghost World, American Splendor. But it's doing something very different. I think that it's such a complete vision that Owen Klein's done here, and so dexterous in the way that it's balancing all these elements, that it is a comedy, it is an outsider artist piece, it is also lacerating in some of its ironic touches, particularly around this main character. But it is also very loving about the art form. It doesn't undermine the art form that just because the main character, it happens to be the way he is. There's a great tagline on the American poster for this, which is that it's the story of New Jersey's next best comic book artist and biggest dick. And that's sort of what it is. You could say in some ways this is like a feature film gender flipped adaptation of the pulp song Common People, because he could call his dad and he could stop it all, but he wants to be in this cellar with these sweaty old guys for his art. And it says something about the artist in that sense, that they are glomming onto outsized strange characters just to turn it into their comics, rather than necessarily being that way themselves. And the depiction of the comic book world feels almost post-apocalyptic to me. One of the central locations is a comic book store, a real comic book store, but it's still littered with standees from the 1990s. And there doesn't seem like there are any new comics there. It's all dusty, yellowing, secondhand comics that have been sold and bought and resold back. It doesn't really feel like there's much lifeblood there. However, in the art that Robert and his friends make, they're working in a tradition that still is rich and vibrant. But then you have a character like Wallace that comes on the scene, and that's almost an in-joke for comics fans that he was an inker, I think he was, as well as a colorist, for Image in the early 1990s, which for some people is seen as almost like the dregs of a certain comic book industry, and the complete opposite of the wonky, cartoonish, very vulgar comics, but funny comics that Robert wants to work in. So then he meets this guy whose art was the big muscles upon muscles upon muscles superheroes of the early 1990s. So it's also rich with in-jokes for comics nerds as well. And it's been really fascinating since the premiere at Cannes, where it went over well with critics, seeing different pockets of people seeing it. So like the hipsters seem to have responded to it well. Comic nerds are also kind of coming onto it kind of well. So it's this rare film, which, not that there, I don't know if we can chart four quadrants between normal people, film critics, comics nerds, and
what's the fourth? Just the indifferent masses.
Yeah, exactly. But this one seems to have something for many of those communities.
Yeah, the thing that I kind of found myself slightly worrying about it was because I think this is such a special film that perhaps it's being marketed or. You know, the assumption is this is going to be some sort of twee indie comedy where everybody kind of learns a lesson. And for me, I was delighted that that's what it wasn't. But like, David, do you think it might kind of get a bit lost because there's nothing quite like it out there at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you say that it's going down well. At the same time, I can imagine there being a fairly large chunk of people who maybe wouldn't be so enamored with the film, because it is quite kind of, you know, it's kind of brutal, and you know, some of the content in it is quite sort of hair raising, shall we say. And I think it's one of those films that the people who like it will love it, you know, and it's a film that will kind of be remembered for a long time. It's not just going to be one of those sort of ephemeral film comedies that, you know, pops up on Netflix in a few years and you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. But like, it's actually something that I think people might, you know, will be inclined to watch again and again, and this will be a kind of film that, you know, will go on Criterion and, you know, will be coming out in Owen Klein retrospectives in the future. You know, like it's a proper kind of like, you know, memorable, important debut. I think going off what Michael said before as well, I think one of the interesting things about it as well is this, it very much is made by someone who has all these kind of weird passions, and he's getting this kind of this, he's getting the ultimate outlet to be able to present them in film. And I think the film, if you like, I sort of met Owen and did a Q&A with him, and the impression that you get is that this film is very much a kind of like psychological, like inside the mind of Owen Klein, like inside his toy box, inside his this is his sort of the shelves of his bedroom wall, this is his record collection, his comic collection, and the books he's read and the films he's seen. You know, it's like, it's very much like a kind of memory scrapbook like thrown up on the screen. But at the same time, I think through the character of Miles, he's definitely trying to kind of dismantle this idea of like, you know, all artists are these kind of sacred beings, and being an artist is something that is sacred and should exist outside the confines of kind of polite, friendly society. And I think Robert is driven by this idea that he can only, like, being an artist allows him to be, as the poster says, a dick, basically, because, you know, he's almost like existing for this higher form. Whereas like Robert, Wallace, meanwhile, Miles is his funny friend, but Wallace, meanwhile, is someone who is like the opposite of that, who is an artist who has no, who kind of doesn't see any kind of gravity or pleasure in having done that job. As you know, even though there are people like Robert who are kind of worshipping him for his work, he's just like, well, I was just a guy doing a job, you know. And I think the film is really like weighing up that idea at its core, that is about like, what is an artist, you know? You know maybe it's saying as you grow older, the idea of being an artist changes within you. Like when you're young, it's all about passion and attaining this sort of hallowed status. When you grow older, you actually see it as more of a job, and it's a way to get income. It's a boring thing that it's a grind that you have to go through. So it's quite sort of like, you know, perspicacious in that sense, in that it's sort of showing the lifetime of like what perceptions, what the perception of being an artist is. So, you know, beyond all the funnies and the jokes, it's there's something quite deep at the core, I think.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to be able to balance that sort of jaded feeling when it comes to the creativity of so many people in this and the foolishness of many of the choices with actually like a genuine respect and also like a bit of a reverence for what the art form is. Michael, before we move on to the film, I am really excited to hear your thoughts on, when it came to funny pages, did this seem a more kind of compelling coming of age than you experienced with Hatching?
Ooh, interesting. Because yes, this is an impossible to market film, and coming of age is one of those terms that's being put into some of those tweets, some of those YouTube descriptions and marketing copy. Is it a coming? I don't think you can class it as a coming of age, because so much of it is about arrested development and stubbornness. And maybe in some ways that is more true to life than we see in other coming-of-age movies. Because if, you know, I'm speaking for myself here, but if I look back on my life, there's no one great summer or one great moment where I decided I was an adult.
Could be coming. Could be next summer.
Exactly, yeah. At age 36, I'm going to finally become an adult. But yeah, this feels like it gets to the heart of some ugliness and some truth, and in a way that's something that is purely metaphorical, like Hatching. I don't want to kick Hatching too much. That was good. You know, we talked about that in its own way. But the Funny Pages does seem to be mining an area of the creative brain, particularly a young creative brain, which just feels like everything around it is matter to be chewed up and spat out, it tackles that in a way that's really fascinating and interesting, the relationship between the artist and their subject. In a similar way, we mentioned the Safdies up top, and maybe that's the best way to sort of home in on. The Safdies aspect is probably the strongest thing to recommend this on. If you saw Good Time or Uncut Gems and strip out the genre trappings of that and look at their protagonists and how their protagonists are so self-involved but so exploitative of everyone around them just to get what they need. There's a lot to compare Robert with Pattinson's character, R-Pat's character in Good Time here, the way that he responds to other people just to get ahead in his life. And the co-producer here, Ronald Bronstein, was the star and behind the camera as well on Daddy Longlegs, the earlier Safdie Brothers film, which we did a live show, a live screening, a live podcast of a couple of years ago. That film is very close to this one. So if I had to figure out a marketing strategy for this, I'd say an unlikely coming of age story. I'd say the story of New Jersey's biggest dick. But also I'd hammer home that Safdie connection. It really does ring true.
We should get some scores on this. David, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect? Not that you need me to remind me of your own scale.
No. I'm going to say fours across the board. It's a really very, very fine debut. I had a good time with it. I'd happily watch it again. I think there are kind of untapped depths to it. And just one final little thing which I feel duty bound to mention. So we've got an interview with Owen in our current issue of Little White Lies, which is on sale now through all good magazine sellers. And one of the things we talked about was the use of a song "Uh-Oh" by the band The Nutty Squirrels, which is a kind of squirrel pop chart sensation from the mid 50s, which he uses in a brilliant way in the film. And it's just one of it, again, it's very sort of emblematic of his tastes. And since seeing the film, actually, I've started to play "Uh-Oh" a lot. And me and my young daughter, it's become a kind of like clarion call for bath time. So whenever I put "Uh-Oh" on, she basically automatically gets ready for bath. So like, yeah, it's nice actually, and she sings along with it as well. So that's been a little extra bonus feature for this film for me.
A little Pavlovian experiment. Lovely.
Exactly. Nutty squirrel.
Michael, what about you?
Pavlov squirrel.
Squirrel pop. Squirrel pop needs a resurgence, doesn't it? I'd say I'd like to rewatch this film. You know, I'm hesitant to give films fives, but this is a very strong fours across the board for me as well. Likely to go up to a five on a rewatch, I think. And only maybe a four in retrospect, because as David said, this feels like it's the entirety of Owen Klein's brain tipped onto screen. And I'm very curious to see what he does next, particularly because I wonder if he's just left everything on the table here. Because it does feel like such a complete vision. But I'm looking forward to see what he does next. He's definitely a strong voice to look out for.
Yeah, I think the circumstance of when I watched it was I knew nothing about it going in. I assumed it was some kind of twee indie coming of age thing that I'm allergic to. So maybe a one or a two coming into it. Five in enjoyment. I think the second that Matthew Mayer comes on screen, I had a moment of like, oh shit, things are about to get real. And I was just really, really surprised by it throughout, which is, you know, so rare when you watch as many films as you do that like something completely takes you off guard. And probably a four in retrospect. I watched it because I was interviewing Owen, who is an absolute delight and, you know, such an interesting guy. And then kind of going through it afterwards with him and picking apart all the little influences that he had. I'm really excited to see what he does next.
We've all interviewed Owen, right?
Oh, great. Oh, wow. So, Owen is available if people want to chat to him.
We really should have mentioned that at the top, so it could have been a full disclosure thing.
Yes, friend of the group, Yeah. he's a strong actor, but I really want him to stay on this side of the camera. But yeah. Yeah, that is. Has this ever happened before that we all three people have interviewed the same guy?
Probably not for the same film in the same release week.
Next up, Angel's Egg. A mysterious young girl wanders a desolate, otherworldly landscape, carrying a large egg. So, Michael, there's a letter by Bill Gunn that I always love to read, where he has a line where he says, sometimes the job of the critic is to just shut up and listen. So I kind of just want to shut up and listen. You talk about Angel's Egg.
This is a really interesting film club pick for something like Hatching, where Hatching really wants you to know what it's talking about. Like, this is what it's about. It's all these things. It's not finished the term, but it's a smorgasbord of themes in Hatching. Whereas Angel's Egg, both the two key creators behind this film have said in interviews, we don't know what it's about. It really is the epitome of just vibes kind of animation. And it's so powerful as an art film. And I suppose to give it some context about what this film is, Mamoru Oshii, we've mentioned him earlier, he made, directed Ghost in the Shell in the mid-1990s, which for most people who are sort of casual watchers of Japanese animation, that's probably one of the one or two films you're likely to have seen. And it's a blockbuster but very thoughtful, ideas-packed sci-fi, futuristic dystopian sci-fi film, looking at the nature of humanity and post-humanity, and was a large influence on The Matrix. But Oshii, as a filmmaker, is probably as iconoclastic as they come. And this is one of the key stages in that. Up until this point, he'd been working in the animation sort of machine. He was a director on a long-running series called Urusei Yatsura, which was a sort of magical girl anime. And he directed that through some very successful years and then completely split his audience with one feature film where he just sort of threw out the tone and style of what had come before and turned it into a confounding time loop sci-fi type drama. And so he was out on his ass from the animation industry and tried to pitch around to make other features with different franchises and studios, and none of his ideas were sticking because they were just too off the wall. So instead he makes this very independent movie in collaboration with Yoshitaka Amano, who did a lot of the character designs, world design, concept art for this. He would then later go on to be a key figure in the concept art for the Final Fantasy video game series. From pretty much this year onwards, for the 20 years following this, he'd do the majority of character designs for that and cover artwork for the games. And this just stands almost separate from most of Japanese animation history, because it is a confounding art film, unabashedly so, that is still powerful to this day. Really, it reveals that Oshii was much more of a fan of European cinema and animation. He was a guy who, as a kid, his dad was a private detective, and between gigs would just take his son to the cinema. So he was brought up on European cinema. He was a huge fan of Godard, Bergman, Tarkovsky, and he'd talk about not just the tone of European cinema, but the landscape of Europe as being something, post-war Europe as being something that inspired him. And that's completely in this film, this desolate European blighted landscape that these two characters are walking across with this large egg, then also all these biblical references and themes coming to the fore. But I'm really interested to know what you two sort of made of this as well, because there is no correct answer what it's about. And of course we all have expectations and prejudices when we come to anime, expecting a certain sort of maybe kinetic, action-packed kind of expressionistic sort of style, and this is the ante of all of that. So what do you make of it?
It keeps changing. I suppose to me it seemed very much like a film about faith. and about kind of clinging onto hope and whether or not you can kind of nurture something in this sort of hellish post-apocalyptic landscape, whether it's worth kind of sowing the seeds of the future at any point. But yeah, I mean, David, what about you? It feels like, it really does feel like there's hours of discussion to be had with this one.
What I'd say to you, Michael, is that maybe, and maybe you can correct me on this, but like I feel that with a lot of anime, even the sort of famous stuff like Akira, Ghost in the Shell, the storylines and what they're about are often very obscure, and like the I think that the way that those films tell stories are sometimes, you know, do verge on the experimental, and there's lots of kind of like references, and even something like Ghost in the Shell, I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I've just got this memory of being like, I'm not entirely sure what happens in the movie, even though it is this kind of, you know, classic text now. And I think, and that's, you know, that's not meant as a criticism. So I maybe came to this knowing that it was sort of difficult, but kind of thinking, well, it's going to be difficult in that sort of anime way where, you know, it's enjoyable and approachable on this completely different aesthetic and emotional level. And yeah, I think this is what this was. And I was really kind of, you know, stunned by it. Just its boldness and its kind of absolute complete refusal to conform to give you a kind of like nudge in any particular direction, to give you any kind of catharsis. I mean, the final shot of the film is this kind of long, it's like something that you just don't ever see in animation, which is a long take. You like, I mean, you know, that it sort of goes against the actual kind of the sort of central conceit of animation, where, you know, it's a long process, you know, you have limited time, you have to tell the story, like, and obviously with animation you have so much recourse to images, you can do anything you want, so why would you do a long take? And the final sort of 2-3 minutes of the film is this kind of long pullback shot of the of this desolate world, and then it just ends, and like it's like jaw dropping. Like, you're like, wow, like how can a film, how can an animation film do that, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it feels like it's done, you know, Oshii was completely ring fenced and completely, you know, it's a film of a free man, as the old saying goes. Like, you know, there was clearly no producers cracking the whip, no one saying that we had to make our money back on this. At the same time, I feel that it's the sort of thing that would have, especially in Japan, would have created this, like, you know, was it this cult phenomenon? Like, was it? No,
it was a failure, and he says that it put him in director prison for maybe 4 years after this. He didn't really make another major animated series or feature until the end of the 80s after this.
One of the other, so just for context as well, but I'd seen a couple of Oshii films before, before this. In fact, a fair few. One of the first films of his I saw was my first ever. It was like the second or third film I saw. So I saw it back to back with Satoshi Kon's Paprika. But I saw this movie called The Amazing Lives of the Fast Food Grifters, which was this kind of, I thought, oh, it's Oshii. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a cool, fun animation. And it was like this kind of 2-hour philosophical tract, like completely impenetrable. Everyone walked out. It was like these kind of weird hand puppets of fast food based superheroes talking extensively in these monologues about, like, very obscure monologues about Japanese history. And, you know, I really got this. I mean, I sat through it, but was completely baffled by it, and remember thinking, wow, this is the Ghost in the Machine guy, and he's like you know, he's some modern philosopher. He's not a filmmaker. He's obviously got some, you know, desire to be writing these, you know, dense philosophical tracts about, you know, cult, like Japanese culture and history. And so, you know, seeing a film like Angel's Egg, it kind of fits into the puzzle of his career. You know, he is complete, like, hardcore intellectual who is making these, you know, working in a form that is mainstream and populist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but I suppose you're hitting on something there. He's not a conventional animation filmmaker in the sense that animation is just one of the many tools he uses. Around this time, he was also ready, you know, it was kickstarting a sort of live action filmmaking career. He was also writing radio plays and novellas and all sorts. He only would use animation sparingly, and he wasn't really a dream weaver, or whatever we'd call popular animation filmmakers. He was a polemicist. Well, he is. He's still around. He is a polemicist. He is an iconoclast. He does want to explore philosophical themes and political history, and world history, all this stuff. I'm glad you hit upon the long takes in the film, because there's one that happens just before that final shot where it's the girl is on the sort of altar and the soldier is sat next to her, and it's almost like the sun is rising across the and that reminded me of Simon Lang. Art cinema is the sort of reference point you have when watching this film, rather than putting it necessarily in the same bracket as Akira or Spirited Away. It does exist in a different world, and that is how this film has been embraced. It's been embraced by the sort of online letterbox cinephiles who will put, you know, don't see the boundaries between genres and art forms.
So I'm just wondering if you could, so in terms of this, in terms, sorry, again, COVID, in terms of Oshii's legacy, how do you kind of place this? You said it was a kind of disaster. It's now got its own following, but like, was it a case where later successes made people go back and like reassess this kind of more impenetrable work?
It has been reassessed. As always, internationally, distribution is always an issue. This film has never, not really been given a proper release, at least in English language territories. But then again, most of his 1980s work hasn't either. I kind of see his career resting on maybe four pillars. There's the film he made before this, Beautiful Dreamer, which was that part of Urusei Yatsura, that series I talked about, which was confounding and split audiences and got him death threats at the time for adding these philosophical themes and experimental storytelling dynamics into what should have been a magical girl anime. But so many filmmakers point to that of the following generation, say that's what opened their eyes to what anime could be and do. So with that, you get Shinichiro Watanabe, who makes Cowboy Bebop in the 2000s. Angel's Egg is another one, because it shows how risk-taking and iconoclastic he could be. But then, and there are then the series and films he made in the Pat Labor miniseries and two features that he makes in the late 80s, early 90s, which is where he marries his European art cinema philosophical sensibilities to a more recognisable genre and form of cinema, which is sort of mecha sci-fi. And he does the same with Ghost in the Shell. I find it interesting, David, that you do say you don't remember what happens in Ghost in the Shell, because I think that is one where the plot is so thin. It's a much shorter film than you remember, but it's full of visual ideas and of these questions that linger and have inspired people to this day. But he's an odd figure. He's a bit of an edgelord nowadays, taking to task all of the sacred cows of animation. He has a really spiky relationship with Ghibli and Hayao Miyazaki. Says, I think his famous quote is that he thinks that Hayao Miyazaki is a bit too obsessed with young girls, and a particular sort of idealized young girl that only exists in Miyazaki's head. But that's sort of a very fun industry sort of joshing that goes on, because around this time as well, in 1985, Oshii very almost made a film with Ghibli. So Ghibli was founded just before Angel's Egg came out, and he was going to make a film with Miyazaki as a producer, but at the, I think, one of their early production meetings, he fell out with him and that never worked with him ever again.
Wow. Yeah,
but thank you very much. I hope people will now seek it out. I mean, sadly, it is just kind of sitting on YouTube because I don't think anybody's kind of after the rights of it. But if that's the way that this work gets seen, that's better than it disappearing altogether, I suppose.
So it does. It does get the odd screening over here. I think it most recently was screened. Was it up in Cambridge? Or so, it does get shown every now and then. There are ways to license it for the big screen, but maybe not for the home end. But keep an eye out in the listings. Maybe you'll have the chance to see it in the cinema, because I think this is such a good cinema film as well. If you have the chance to see it,
Google alert is going to be immediately put on for me the next time it's shown. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's time for Florence Pugh to gaslight, gatekeep, and girl boss her way out of Don't Worry, Darling. Hong Sang-soo is back in typically beguiling form with In Front of Your Face. And on Film Club, Cassavetes tells the story of a woman under the influence. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Proof the Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week, David Jenkins and Michael Leader. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.